Hello, my name is Leila Ilaraza. I'm a student project manager here at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues at Dickinson College. Today, I am joined by Dr. Carlos Vargas Ramos, Adjunct Associate Professor of Political Science at Columbia University and the Director of Public Policy, External and Media Relations and Development at the Center for Puerto Rican Studies at Hunter College. Yesterday, October 10th, Dr. Vargas Ramos gave a lecture for the Clark Forum titled Puerto Rico, the 51st State, explaining the diminished prospects for Puerto Rico statehood. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
At your talk yesterday, when explaining the historical context for Puerto Rico's political status to the United States, you mentioned a group of Supreme Court cases called the insular cases to differentiate between unincorporated and incorporated status. As a starting point for our conversation today, could you explain what the insular cases are and what they meant for the island?
So insular cases are the collection of Supreme Court cases that began to be heard by the U.S. Supreme Court almost immediately after Puerto Rico became part of the United States as a territory, right? I think that the first one was from 1899. But the most significant ones, different people grouped them differently. Some people say it's about six or seven cases. Other people say that it's about a dozen cases. So they vary. But for the purposes of the conversation that we were having last night, I would say that there are two that are pretty significant, Downs versus Bidwell and the Balzac versus Puerto Rico cases. The Downs versus Bidwell, as well as the Lima versus Roswell, those are the two that really established that Puerto Rico was seen by the U.S. Supreme Court as an unincorporated territory, which was a complete departure from any other understanding of what territories of the United States had. And there were actually tax cases, there were tariffs cases, whether the United States could levy tariffs on Puerto Rico. And the decisions were actually schizophrenic to some extent, because on the one hand, it indicated that Puerto Rico needed to be considered foreign for the purposes of domestic taxation, whereas the other one said, no, Puerto Rico needs to be considered domestic for foreign taxation purposes, right? So it established this weird argumentation, but the practical result was that Puerto Rico was seen, and the other territories were seen as unincorporated territories.
Due to Puerto Rico's unincorporated status and its effects on citizenship for those on the island, there have been arguments claiming Puerto Ricans have a second-class citizenship. What does this mean for Puerto Ricans on the island in terms of citizenship? And does that change in any way when they're on the mainland?
Let's say that that argument that Puerto Ricans are second-class U.S. citizens for the following reason. First of all, Congress, as part of the Jones Act, the Jones-Shafroth Act of 1917, did extend U.S. citizenship to the residents of Puerto Rico who had been born in Puerto Rico and who did not refuse to accept U.S. citizenship. Since that time, because previously, in 1900, 1902, 1904, the Supreme Court had declared that Puerto Rico was an unincorporated territory, and therefore Congress could treat Puerto Rico differently from incorporated territories or U.S. states, Congress did so. And it was on the basis of that different treatment, which oftentimes meant that Puerto Rico was treated worse than other territories, incorporated territories or states, that U.S. citizenship in Puerto Rico was of a second-class order. The Supreme Court, in the case that I mentioned last night, Balzac versus Puerto Rico, 1922, indicated that no, on the contrary, that it's not that the U.S. citizenship that Puerto Ricans in Puerto Rico have is second-class. Rather, it is that Puerto Rico is an unincorporated territory and therefore it could be treated differently by the U.S. Congress. However, the court itself said, if those Puerto Ricans who are U.S. citizens want to travel to the United States and they are free to do so, they may do so and enjoy all the same rights and privileges as other U.S. citizens enjoy in the United States. But as I pointed out last night in class, we could argue and talk about what has been the experience of those Puerto Ricans who have indeed moved from Puerto Rico to the United States. Have they enjoyed the same rights and privileges of other U.S. citizens while in the United States proper? And that is arguable. And there's a history that shows that none. In fact, Puerto Ricans were discriminated against, just like other groups in the United States have been discriminated against. Was it because Puerto Ricans' U.S. citizenship was second class, or was it because the United States system did not allow for racialized groups to be treated as equal?
Shifting focus a little bit, as part of your research, you examine voter participation and referendums regarding the island status in Puerto Rico. At your talk yesterday, you touched on a decline in voter participation in Puerto Rico in 2016. Notably, residents of Puerto Rico also cannot vote in general presidential elections, but can vote in primaries. Mm-hmm. What are the general trends that you see of voter participation in presidential elections and referendums for Puerto Rico residents? And as a follow-up, why was there a drop in participation in 2016?
The only way being a resident of Puerto Rico would allow a Puerto Rican to participate in U.S. presidential politics is by participating in the primary process. And by and large, the participation of the Puerto Rican electorate in that primary process is very, very, very slow and low, rather. It does not resonate. It's not part of the political discourse in Puerto Rico. U.S. politics, even though they can be very important and tangible in regards to their effects on Puerto Rico, they do not resonate among the electorates and the parties that exist in Puerto Rico. So that's one. That's why the participation rate is so low. And also, it's inconsequential because by the time people in Puerto Rico turn out to vote in primary elections passes, the nomination has already been clinched or has already been anticipated. So it's not that the vote of residents of Puerto Rico and the assigning of delegates to whatever presidential candidate is going to have any measurable impact. So it's mostly symbolic. Now, politics in Puerto Rico, electoral politics in Puerto Rico, have been very contentious, have been very contested over the course of decades. But I argue that the regime, the Commonwealth regime, which is the current form of the territorial government organization, that has become exhausted. That regime is not able to provide for economic growth, is not able to provide for the basic needs that the people of Puerto Rico are demanding of its government, and therefore they are tired of the political parties that are not able to provide effective and efficient solutions to the problems, the mounting problems that Puerto Rico has. My contention is that the electorates have become completely disenchanted with the political parties, completely disenchanted with the political class, and they have therefore given up on voting at the same levels they used to vote before.
In regards to referendums pertaining status in Puerto Rico, yesterday you talked about how boycott is used as a means of protest and different political parties will band together to support a boycott. Mm-hmm. How does that protest work? Could you get into some of the intricacies of that? And is it effective, essentially, if we keep having, there have been six or seven referendums since, I believe, the 60s. Is it effective? What other strategies have been used, if any?
It is effective if you want to block an option that you don't appreciate, you don't want. So that's why I made the analogy of being almost a game of tic-tac-toe, right? What you want to do is you try to advance your preference for statehood or independence or Commonwealth, or you try to block a preference that is not yours. So in that sense, yes, boycott, when it has been labeled and organized and strategized as opposition to either the process or a particular question, yes, it has been effective to the extent that it has been put into effect. And we noticed that in the 2020 plebiscites, that was not put into effect. Prior to that, it was definitely in effect in the 2012, in 1967 even, to some extent in 1998. But in 2020, for whatever reason, the opponents of statehood did not actively and in a sustained manner oppose the process, which is why perhaps more people turned out to vote in 2020 than in 2017, and why the option for statehood may have won a simple majority of the electors.
Incorporating Puerto Rico into the Union would require a lot of political and legal change, both on the island and in the mainland. Last night, you touched on the political power balance in Congress and how that affects policy or lack thereof pertaining to Puerto Rico's status. What are some partisan challenges and arguments for statehood currently in Congress?
First of all, you know, as I pointed out, because Puerto Rico has a lot of population, if it were to become a state, it would have more political representation than more than 20 states. So technically, you would have 20 states that may not want to lose out proportionately to political power. That's number one. Number two, there is the partisan consideration that because Puerto Rico, for whatever reason, is seen in the United States as a Democrat or Democrat-leaning state, you would have Republicans who would oppose Puerto Rico to come into the Union as a state that would give more power to the Democrats. Number three, because there is, you know, if we look at the trajectory of previous admissions of territories into the Union, they tended to balance power. You would admit one state that was Republican, another one that was Democrat, that was acceptable. There is no comparable territory right now in the portfolio of territories that the United States has that would balance Puerto Rico politically in the Congress of the United States.
Historically, Puerto Rico has been colonized for hundreds of years, first by Spain, and then after the Spanish-American War by the United States. What did Puerto Rico's political autonomy look like under Spanish colonization? And then how did that change when the U.S. acquired it?
Certainly, when Puerto Rico had autonomy under Spain, that grant of autonomy happened in 1897, Puerto Rico was able to organize its own government. Whereas when the United States came in 1898, it eliminated that government. The civilian government that it allowed beginning in 1900 did not have an elected governor, did not have an elected Senate. That did not happen until 1917 and ultimately until 1947. So it took half a century to acquire the same levels of autonomy that Puerto Rico had under Spanish colonialism than under U.S. colonialism.
With hundreds of years of colonization, the island still has its own fairly distinct culture. At your talk, you mentioned that around 94 to 96% of people on the island are Puerto Rican, whether born on the mainland or in Puerto Rico. How has Puerto Rican culture remained so distinct from U.S. culture, and have there been any governmental restrictions against that culture historically?
First of all, Puerto Rico is a Latin American country. As a former Spanish colony for 400 years, Puerto Rico's concept of peoplehood and mores and way of life were the experience of the Spaniards in the Western Hemisphere, therefore Spanish-American, Hispanic-American, Latin-American. The United States did try to, quote-unquote, Americanize the people of Puerto Rico, but they resisted it because they found it to be foreign, an imposition, troublesome, bothersome, and impractical because it didn't really affect their daily lives in Puerto Rico. And then as Puerto Rico began to acquire more autonomy, the government, the colonial government, the Commonwealth government, made it a point to cultivate a distinct Puerto Rican culture, highlighting literature, arts, writing, music, foods, and it did so through festivals, through competitions, through educational system in Puerto Rico. So that contributed to foment an idea of a Puerto Rican identity that was separate and apart from that of the United States.
Especially in the 1950s, there was this rise of Puerto Rican nationalism, which you mentioned last night has kind of decreased in recent decades. How do nationalistic sentiments currently differ from Puerto Ricans on the island and Puerto Ricans in the mainland, if at all?
It's hard to gauge because it is not something that is part of public opinion polls, which would be the easiest way perhaps to capture that. And it also depends on where in the United States those Puerto Ricans may be. For instance, it's been said that the Puerto Rican community in Chicago has been much more nationalistic than Puerto Rican communities in New York or Orlando or what have you. The organizations that have been created in Orlando versus Chicago versus New York versus New Jersey, in Chicago they tend to be much more nationalistic than the ones elsewhere. But besides that, it's difficult to gauge how people, the rank and file, feel about it. And there is also the perception that there may be more nationalists or people with nationalist sentiments in the United States than in Puerto Rico. And if that is the case, and it's hard to gauge at this point, it may be because that cultural nationalism that was created in Puerto Rico was transferred to the United States among Puerto Ricans as a way to defend themselves against the discrimination those Puerto Ricans suffered in the United States. So they were able to deploy this idea of nationalism, national pride, advocating for independence as a way to advocate for equal treatment and a defense against unequal treatment on the part of forces in the United States. That may not have been so to the same extent in Puerto Rico, particularly towards the latter part of the 20th century and early 21st century, than it may have been in the middle of the 20th century.
This is a very broad question, and it might negate some of the nuances, but as a researcher in this particular topic, what do you see as the future status of the island? Mm-hmm. Is statehood even feasible? Mm-hmm. Is independence?
As I mentioned last night, statehood is definitely not in the cards at present. Most people in Puerto Rico do not want independence. Could Congress conceivably declare Puerto Rico independence in spite of the fact that Puerto Ricans do not want to be independent? It could happen. It is within the power of the Congress. But I think that what pervades is inertia. There is nothing that is forcing the Congress of the United States to take action in any way, shape, or form. There is no domestic pressure. There is no external pressure. The pressure that is being exerted from the people and the electorate in Puerto Rico is mixed. So as a result of that, I don't see much change in the condition of Puerto Rico, with the exception perhaps of measures that may alleviate the economic crisis in Puerto Rico. And that may not touch upon the status question. So I don't see a change in status for the foreseeable future.
The next question is a little off topic from questions of status. Some of your research has focused on the racial makeup of mm-hmm. Puerto Ricans and how more Puerto Ricans on the island view themselves as white than Puerto Ricans on the mainland. Why is there this discrepancy?
Similar to the answer that I gave in relation to whether Puerto Ricans in Puerto Rico may feel more or less nationalistic compared to Puerto Ricans in the United States, because Puerto Rico is a Latin American country with Latin American conceptions of race and ethnicity, and with practices of race and ethnicity that are very Latin American in Puerto Rico. When Puerto Ricans migrated to the United States, they may have seen themselves as white, but that is not necessarily how they were treated in the United States. So that dissonance that took place between what they thought themselves to be versus how they were treated created a learning process, and they were challenged, and some may have asserted their whiteness. Some others said, well, fine, I am not being treated as white. I am being treated as Puerto Rican, which is an ethnicity, it's a nationality, it's not a race, but it's an ethnicity or nationality that has become racialized. So many people say, okay, well, I am Puerto Rican. What are you? Are you black? Are you white? And I'm Puerto Rican. And that may entail perhaps some of the admixture that does exist among Puerto Ricans, but it also creates some uncertainty in declaring oneself along understandings of racial identity in the United States. So by saying that I am Puerto Rican and not wanting to declare, oh, I am white or I am black or I am mixed race, you're also challenging the notions of race and ethnicity that are pervasive in the United States.
That makes me think about standardized testing questions mm-hmm. in high school and college. They would ask for your ethnicity, and they'd ask for your race, and they'd say white, in parentheses, not Hispanic. And that always kind of threw me for a loop because of the makeup of the U.S. mm-hmm. and so many different cultures mixing together, mm-hmm. and is being Hispanic a race, mm-hmm. and all of these mm-hmm. questions. So I always found that very interesting.
And I will say that that is going to be even more complicated now because the Office of Management and Budget, which regulates those questions, has approved a proposal to merge the question on race and ethnicity in the census questionnaires and other questionnaires in U.S. Documents. So that right now there is a question on identity. How do you identify yourself? Black, white, Hispanic, Middle Eastern, or North African, etc. So that is going to complicate matters even.
And for our last question, what are you currently working on at the Centro, and where can our listeners find more about your work?
Well, certainly the best way to get to the work that we all do collectively at the Center for Puerto Rican Studies is to go to our website, centropr.hunter.cuny.edu. That's the best way to get. And we have tons of resources. We have the largest library and archives on the Puerto Rican experience in the United States, actually anywhere outside of Puerto Rico. We have research that we conduct in our data hub, our data center, and then we have pages for different researchers. So that is the best resource you can access. What is wonderful about our website is that it can lead you to the different components of the center. For instance, many of the resources in the library and archives have been digitized, so they can be viewed. You don't have to come to the center to view them. We also have a TV channel. We have series, you know, called Puerto Rican Voices, now on its sixth season, where you can view the production that we have put together on different issues affecting the Puerto Rican community here in the United States and in Puerto Rico. So those resources are available through our website. And then in terms of the research that I am doing, I am still working on the effect of race and ethnicity, particularly on political behavior in Puerto Rico. That is my latest research. It's still underway. You know, it's moving slowly. We provide data. We provide data on Puerto Ricans throughout the United States, and that is also something that is ongoing.
I look forward to seeing more of the work that comes out of there. This concludes our interview. On behalf of the Clark Forum, thank you again for sitting down and having this conversation. If you're interested in hearing Dr. Vargas Ramos's full talk, you can check out our website at clarkforum.org.